Imagine waking up tomorrow morning and the power grid is just completely down.
Oh man,
And not just your neighborhood, right? Like everywhere. No internet, no cell service, zero cloud servers humming away in those giant, distant data centers.
just total radio silence.
Exactly. In our current reality, for most of us anyway, that smartphone sitting on your nightstand instantly becomes this useless, expensive rectangle of glass and plastic.
Yeah, a very expensive paperweight.
Right, because its entire existence is built around connecting to the internet. When that connection is severed, the device is essentially dead. But what if it didn't have to be? What if that piece of glass could actually be the key to rebuilding?
It really forces us to confront this major vulnerability in how we live. I mean, we are just so accustomed to our devices being completely dependent on an umbilical cord connected to the cloud.
We really are.
We've kind of accepted this unspoken rule that the actual intelligence of our technology lives somewhere else. And our phones are just, well, dumb terminals, basically, just displaying what the server tells them to.
Yeah, just a screen for a computer that's 1,000 miles away. And today we are looking at something that completely shatters that assumption. Our mission for this deep dive is to unpack this incredibly fascinating piece of source material. It's called the NWO BlaSec-BWOX Off-Grid System Architecture and Operation Manual.
And it is quite the document. I mean, it's dense.
It is so dense.
But at its core, it's a blueprint. It's a blueprint for a self-contained, completely decentralized command node. It basically maps out how to take consumer hardware, the stuff you already own, and turn it into a sovereign unit of survival and coordination.
And here is the absolute kicker for me. It is designed as a single browser app, just a cockpit. And underneath that cockpit, it runs completely independent of central servers. We are talking about packing artificial intelligence, tactical robotics, and like an entire digital economy into a locally running, completely off-grid stack.
Which sounds like science fiction, but it's all mapped out right there.
It really does. So whether you are a hardcore tech enthusiast, a survivalist, or just, insanely curious about the future of decentralized computing, this deep dive is going to completely reframe how you view the capabilities of the smartphone that's sitting in your pocket right now.
Absolutely. Because this isn't just doomsday prepping, it's really an absolute masterclass in extreme edge computing.
Edge computing on steroids, basically.
Yeah, the manual doesn't just, theorize about off-grid survival. It provides a functioning multi-layered architecture. It proves that the device you already have has this immense, completely untapped potential if you just fundamentally change the software paradigm that's running on it.
So let's start at the very beginning, because the first problem you face when the grid goes down isn't it's not how to run a robot dog, right?
No, definitely not.
It's how to talk to your neighbor. If there are no cell towers and no Wi-Fi routers, how on earth do you move data from point A to point B? Because without communication, every single device is just an isolated island.
And that isolation is exactly what the foundational layer of the black box system solves. They use what's called a mesh network layer.
Okay.
And it relies on a radio frequency technology called LoRa, which is paired with a protocol called Meshtastic.
LoRa, meaning long range,
Right.
right.
LoRa stands for long range. So think about traditional Wi-Fi. It tries to blast a ton of data over a very short distance, which obviously takes a massive amount of power.
Yeah, it drains your battery super fast.
Exactly. But LoRa does the exact opposite. It is incredibly, as they say, battery sippy. It uses very, very low power to send small amounts of data over multi-kilometer ranges. And best of all, it operates on completely license-free radio bands.
Meaning you don't need some telecommunications company's permission to use it.
Nope.
And you certainly don't need their infrastructure.
Exactly. But the architecture goes even beyond just those specialized radios. It utilizes a device-to-device mesh. So your actual phone can pair directly with other phones nearby using the hardware it already has built in.
Like, what kind of hardware?
Things like Bluetooth Low Energy and Wi-Fi Direct.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's like a digital bucket brigade.
That's a perfect way to describe it.
If you imagine every phone as a person standing in a line, passing drops of data from hand to hand, like my phone connects to yours via Bluetooth, and then your phone connects to a LoRa radio on your backpack,
Yeah.
and then that radio reaches another person's node like 3 kilometers away, and suddenly we have a functioning network stretching across an entire city without a single cell tower.
And the beauty of that bucket brigade is that it's inherently self-healing.
What do you mean by self-healing?
Well, if one person in that line steps away, or their battery dies or whatever, the network doesn't collapse. The data simply reroutes automatically to the next closest person.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. And the manual details all these practical communication tools built specifically for this kind of, well, fragile network. For instance, they have a file transfer system designed specifically to handle the reality of super low bandwidth.
Because you can't just send a 4K video over that.
No way. If you want to send an image or a PDF, the system actually chunks it up into tiny 16 kilobyte pieces.
Which makes sense, because you can't just shove a massive file through a tiny radio wave all at once. But wait, what happens if hundreds of people are trying to use this bucket brigade at the exact same time? Doesn't the network just get completely overwhelmed and crash?
You would think so, but that's where they implement a mechanism called back pressure.
Back pressure.
Okay. Yeah. It's a networking concept that acts essentially like a smart traffic light. The system is constantly monitoring the network's overall capacity. So if it senses that the invisible radio waves are getting congested.
Like a traffic jam?
Exactly. It tells the transmitting device to actually slow down the data transfer. It automatically paces the delivery so the message eventually gets through without causing a crash that ruins the whole connection for everyone.
Man, that is so clever.
Yeah.
And they also outline an off-grid walkie-talkie voice mode, right?
They do, yeah.
The manual notes it has a built-in delay of a few seconds, which is completely logical if you think about it. I mean, your audio recording is being chopped into those tiny little 16 kilobyte pieces, bounced across a dozen different radios, and then reassembled on the other end.
Right. It's not going to be instant like a phone call.
Plus, they include this tactical map feature that I thought was wild. It caches OpenStreetMap tiles directly onto your device's local storage. So even completely offline, you have this rich, detailed map.
And it's interactive, too.
Yeah. You can plot what they call cursor on target objects. You can mark friendly locations, hazards, neutral zones, whatever. And those map pins actually sync across the mesh to everyone else's screen in real time.
Which means you are looking at literally military-grade situational awareness operating entirely on consumer hardware and communicating over open airways.
Which, okay, that brings up a massive red flag for me.
Let me guess. Security.
Yes. If everything is bouncing around open airwaves, isn't that dangerously insecure? I mean, if my text messages and my location pins are hopping through five random strangers' phones just to get to you, can't anyone just intercept that? Or worse, what if they inject malicious code right into my device?
It's a very valid concern. But the manual authors actually anticipated that exact vulnerability. First off, the mesh chat itself is fully encrypted end-to-end.
Okay, good.
So the data passing through those intermediary phones is completely unreadable to them. Those intermediary phones are just acting as locked briefcases. They carry the data, but they literally can't open it.
Right, but what about the injection thing?
That's the more crucial defense. It's how they handle the data once it actually reaches the destination. They use an incredibly strict prompt injection defense.
How does that actually work in practice, like mechanically?
So essentially, all inbound text from the mesh network is strictly treated as passive data. It is never, under any circumstances, treated as an executable command by the receiving device's operating system.
Huh.
Think of it like receiving a docs in the mail. The system is programmed to only look at the contents of the box as physical objects to be cataloged. It will never read a note inside the box that says, burn this house down and actually follow the instruction.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So an attacker literally cannot text your phone a malicious script and trick your system into running it. It just reads it as plain text.
That is such a brilliant way to handle untrusted networks. You just treat everything as cargo, never ever as instructions.
Exactly.
Okay. So we have a functioning, secure local network. We can communicate. But a network is really just a series of roads, right? What really matters is what is actually driving on them. And this brings us to the intelligence of the system.
This is where it gets crazy.
It really does, because we are so conditioned to think that artificial intelligence requires these massive, energy-hungry server farms in the cloud. We hear constant reports on the news about how AI models need, like, dedicated nuclear power plants just to function.
Oh, yeah, the energy consumption is staggering.
But the black box manual outlines putting the AI directly on the phone itself.
It does. And it achieves this through a mechanism called quantized large language models.
Now, I know we hear the term quantization thrown around a lot in tech circles right now, but what does it actually mean under the hood? Like, how do you fit a supercomputer brain into a smartphone?
Think of quantization kind of like reducing the resolution of a massive, highly detailed photograph. Traditional AI models use very precise, very memory-heavy numbers to make all their mathematical calculations. It's like a photo with billions and billions of pixels.
Okay, I'm with you.
Quantization mathematically rounds those highly precise numbers down to simpler, smaller integers. So the model becomes slightly fuzzier in its precision, but suddenly it takes up a tiny fraction of the memory. It allows a model that would normally require a massive, super expensive server to fit comfortably right into the RAM of a standard smartphone.
And the Black Box Model Library actually lists 13 of these specific phone-sized models, things like Qwen3, Llama 3.2, and Phi3. But it doesn't just, you know, chat with you like a normal bot. It performs something called RAG, or Retrieval Augmented Generation, over your own uploaded documents.
Which is incredibly powerful in a drill-down scenario.
Right, because you can feed it a massive PDF of, say, a city's water infrastructure, or maybe a super complex medical textbook. Then you can ask the AI highly specific questions about those documents, and it reads them and answers you instantly, completely offline.
No API keys required.
Zero. Without ever needing an API key or sending a single byte of your private data to some corporate server.
The intelligence is entirely localized and sovereign, but the architecture actually pushes this even further with a module called Function Gemma Robotics.
Oh man, this part blew my mind.
Yeah, they use a highly specialized compressed AI model, so it's only 270 million parameters that is trained specifically just for tool calling. So you can give it a natural language command using text or even your voice, like move robot dog forward 10 paces. And the AI parses your intent directly on the device.
And here's where it translates that thought into physical action. It uses a localized digital switchboard, like a messaging system that translates your English text directly into the physical motor commands the robot's operating system actually understands.
Sure.
And all of this happens over the local mesh without ever pinging an external server. But I have to admit, my initial thought when reading the performance benchmarks for this was just pure skepticism.
Why is that?
Well, the manual claims the setup can reach roughly 3,200 tokens per second for GPU prefill on just an iPhone 15 Pro. How is that physically possible without draining the battery in 5 minutes or literally melting the phone in your hand?
Well, it comes back to that specialized 270 million parameter model we just mentioned. Because it isn't trying to be a general purpose AI, right?
Yeah.
It's not trying to write poetry and code and translate languages all at once.
Oh, right.
Because of that, it requires vastly less computational overhead. It only knows how to do one single thing, translate human intent into robotic action. That extreme specialization is what allows for that staggering speed without instantly killing the battery.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Efficiency through hyper-specialization. But I have to push back on the physical safety aspect here.
Sure.
Is it really a good idea to let a localized, pocket-sized AI autonomously control physical hardware, like a robotic dog or a drone in an unpredictable off-grid environment? I mean, things could go so wrong.
The authors of the manual clearly recognize that exact risk. They've implemented very rigid, non-negotiable guardrails. For one, any safety-critical call like an emergency stop or a command that could cause physical harm or property damage, it requires manual confirmation from the human operator.
Okay, so the AI can't just go rogue.
Exactly. The AI simply cannot execute it autonomously. It will draft the command, sure, but a human must physically press a button to authorize it.
And what about someone else taking control of the robot? Like hacking it over the mesh.
That is the second major guardrail. The system architecture explicitly excludes all cloud-only communication pathways by design.
Meaning what exactly?
Things like external billing modules, cloud-based fine-tuning, or remote discovery registries, they're cut out entirely. This ensures the robot cannot be hijacked by a remote entity because the robot literally, physically lacks the software pathways to accept commands from the outside internet. It only listens to the localized, authenticated mesh network.
Wow. You physically cut the digital string so nobody else can play the puppet.
That's a great way to put it.
So let's look at the progression here. Your phone is now an offline brain controlling a physical robot. But a robot running tasks still needs physical maintenance, right? Parts, batteries, or maybe just food for the human operator. And if you need to acquire those supplies from another survivor, you run into a massive societal problem. How do you safely trade or pay for goods when the ATMs are dead, the banking system is down, and cash might honestly be useless?
This is where the manual outlines its offline economy. The Black Box includes a Web3 wallet designed to handle instant off-grid payments using various cryptocurrency assets.
And this is where I was genuinely confused during my initial read.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I understand that crypto fundamentally relies on a global decentralized ledger. The entire point of a blockchain is that thousands of computers verify a transaction to prevent you from spending the same digital coin twice.
Right, the double spend problem.
Exactly. So how do you solve the double spend problem with zero internet? How can you possibly have an offline blockchain transaction?
It is genuinely one of the most profound engineering challenges in decentralized finance. And the way this manual solves it is through a store and forward mechanism, which is powered by their offline airdrop engine.
Now, real quick, before we dive into the actual mechanics of that engine, I want to jump in. The manual discusses using the system to distribute what they call NWO UBI, or Universal Basic Income, utilizing various crypto protocols.
Right.
And to be super clear for you listening, whether you view cryptocurrency as the future of money or just a total house of cards, our goal today isn't to endorse this specific UBI program or take any stance on crypto itself. We're impartially looking at the mechanics of how this architecture proposes solving a highly complex computer science problem, which is securely transferring value with zero connectivity.
Exactly. We're just looking at the plumbing here. So to understand how this offline transaction works, think of it kind of like writing a physical check in the real world.
Okay.
When you hand someone a paper check, the money doesn't instantly leave your bank account right then and there. You are handing them a mathematically binding promise, verified by your physical signature, that the funds are theirs.
So in the black box system, an operator with no internet connectivity can digitally sign a mathematically binding promise.
Yes. And that signature is stored locally in the phone's memory. It acts exactly like a digital check.
It's like a message in a bottle.
Yes. And the ocean it's floating in is that mesh network we talked about earlier.
Hmm.
That signed transaction literally rides the mesh. It gets passed from phone to phone across that bucket brigade.
They're just waiting.
Exactly. It sits in a queue until it eventually hits a node, which, you know, could be days later or 100 miles away that happened to have an active internet link.
The moment that node connects to the broader internet, it broadcasts your stored signature to the global blockchain and the transaction finally settles on chain.
And they use this to power the black box market.
Yeah.
You can actually list items for sale. Let's say you have purified water or medical supplies.
Right.
The listing lives on your device and broadcasts out as a mesh promo. It actually drops a geolocation ping on that tactical map we mentioned earlier.
Which is so cool.
Yeah. So if I'm a mile away, I see your ping, I walk over, and I can pay you by scanning a QR code on your device. My payment rides the mesh until it eventually hits the internet and settles. But of course, the moment that transaction does hit the internet, it faces a gauntlet of potential security threats.
Right.
This is why the manual details a quantum secure settlement gate. When your offline transaction finally reaches the internet to settle, it passes through an automated security cascade. It's essentially knocking on the door of the network and asking, what is the strongest lock you can accept right now?
Because the looming fear in cryptography is that future quantum computers will be able to crack our current encryption standards almost instantly.
Precisely. So the system first tries to lock the data using a post-quantum algorithm. This is encryption so complex that even quantum computers shouldn't be able to crack it.
Like crystals dilithium, I think it was called.
Yeah, exactly. But if the receiving network or the current hardware can't handle a lock that heavy, the gate automatically steps down to standard modern encryption, like ED25.1.1 or ECDSA. It is a highly resilient reporting system that guarantees the value transfer happens with the maximum possible security available at that specific microsecond.
Man, it is an incredibly robust vision for a digital economy. But here is the reality check. All this technology is incredible. Moving data, coordinating robots, securing quantum transactions. But ultimately, human operators are flesh and blood.
We are very fragile.
We still need to eat, we need to stay warm, and we get sick. How does the black box bridge the gap between all this high-level digital processing and just fragile human biology?
This is where the system shifts from being a networking tool to a true survival instrument. The manual outlines a comprehensive survival manual that is embedded directly into the app's code as raw JavaScript constants.
Okay, explain why that matters. Why raw JavaScript constants?
Because it means the information doesn't need to be fetched from a database or a server. The moment the app opens, the text is already there, baked directly into the core code.
Oh, so it's impossible not to have it if you have the app.
Exactly. And it covers 30 critical topics, everything from purifying water and building shelters to treating illnesses and navigating by the stars.
Furthermore, they embed a local server module that allows the operator to browse highly compressed offline archives of Wikipedia, including vast medical databases and images.
Yeah, the KeyWik serve module.
Right. I also love how they integrate health diagnostics. It connects to Bluetooth health profiles. So if you have a smartwatch, the black box can pull your heart rate and your blood oxygen levels right into the dashboard. But it goes way beyond consumer wearables. It features clinical connectivity using web serial bridges.
Which is such a fascinating use of existing ports.
It really is. This means you can literally plug clinical equipment like an actual ECG machine or a therapeutic pump directly into your phone's USB port, and the black box can read the data and interface with it locally.
That'd save lives.
It even includes an offline medicine index and a supply inventory tracker.
And tying all of this hardware together is a design philosophy they call honest fallbacks.
Honest fallbacks. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, the software is built to interrogate whatever device it's currently running on, figure out what physical hardware is actually present, and use it without crashing if something is missing.
Like the flashlight function, right?
Yep.
The software pulls the hardware. If your device has a camera flash, it uses that for a lamp and for the automated Morse code SOS feature. But if you're running this on some old, cheap tablet that doesn't have a flash, it gets a null response.
And normally, an app might just crash right there.
Exactly. But instead of throwing an error and crashing, the system honestly falls back and just turns the tablet screen entirely white at maximum brightness to act as a lantern. It just adapts to the physical reality of the moment.
It adapts to external hardware, just as cleverly, too. It can act as a universal remote, driving an infrared blaster to control abandoned TVs or AV equipment.
That's crazy.
But more importantly, it can drive RTL-SDR radio receivers. By plugging a cheap $20 USB radio antenna right into your phone, your device suddenly becomes a powerful tuner capable of pulling down FM, AM, and vital NOAA weather frequencies directly from the airwaves.
It's like an emergency digital multi-tool. It doesn't just give you one functionality, it reads what you have left and maximizes it. And if the computer you are trying to use is completely dead, let's say the operating system is corrupted, the black box has a boot and recovery feature.
Right, the Ubuntu kiosk.
Yeah, you can carry the entire system on a bootable USB drive as a Linux kiosk. You just plug it into the dead machine, bypass the broken Windows or Mac operating system entirely, and launch the entire black box command node right from the thumb drive.
When you step back and look at the sum total of this architecture, the mesh radios passing data like a bucket brigade, the hyper-specialized local AI, the offline economy storing and forwarding transactions, and those seamless hardware bridges, It really represents a profound paradigm shift in how we think about computing architecture. It really, really does. Let's bring this deep dive full circle. The NWO black box isn't just a survival tool for some doomsday scenario. It is a proof of concept. It proves definitively that massive tech stacks, artificial intelligence, tactical robotics, global value transfer, and literally the sum of human knowledge, they don't actually need the cloud to function.
Not at all.
They can be held securely in the palm of your hand, running entirely on local battery power and radio waves.
And that is exactly why this matters to you, the listener, right now. Even if you never face a grid-down apocalypse, this level of edge computing efficiency could revolutionize the everyday applications you use.
Think about it.
Imagine if the technology in your life prioritized blistering speed, absolute data privacy, and personal sovereignty over a constant fragile dependency on centralized corporate servers. It makes you look at that smartphone on your desk a little differently, doesn't it? It isn't just a dumb portal waiting for instructions from a server. It's a dormant supercomputer. Which leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over. If a localized mesh-based network can provide its own secure AI, maintain a functioning economy, coordinate physical robotics, and keep human beings alive completely off the grid.
At what point does this temporary off-grid backup become more reliable, more private, and more appealing than the fragile centralized grid we blindly rely on every single day?
Exactly. Next time your internet goes out, ask yourself, is your phone really just useless glass and plastic, or is it just waiting for the right software?